Welcome to our seminar on the philosophy of transcendence for 19 March here in beautiful Salem. So today, building on all that we have gone through in previous days, we are going to discuss the difference between mundane religion and philosophy and transcendental religion and philosophy. Now, in the few days that remain, we can go into specifics. We can speak, if you like, about Buddhism or about atheistic Sankhya philosophy, etc., etc., etc. As you like, we can go into those subjects. But today, I want to take a foundational or essential approach. There are very clear keys to see whether a religion, a theology, a philosophy is mundane. So, the first thing, as I said, we're referring, this is a very natural progression to go to this subject today based on all that we have heard before. So, it was mentioned day before yesterday, I believe, that in chapter 86 of Krishna book, Srila Prabhupada discusses materialistic society in terms of the koshas, which we talked about, and he says that the mundane civilization is operating within anamaya, pranamaya, and manomaya. So, manomaya, of course, this is human level. This is special human level. The other two activities are there also among animals. So really what distinguishes human society, mundane human society, from animal society is this manomaya, platform of the mind. So, what that means, in essence, is that the material platform, when we speak of materialistic religion, philosophy, it means that which is situated on the mental plane. Beyond this manomaya, there's bijnanamaya, which is the position of the spirit soul. Spirit soul discriminates between, because bijnan means discrimination. So the spirit soul in this realm of consciousness knows I am different from matter. So this is the beginning of spiritual life. And then anandamaya, that is realized through the relationship of that spirit soul and the Lord. So this is, those two koshas belong to transcendence. So when we speak of material religion, material philosophy, obviously, it is that which is going on the mental platform. Now, let us look very carefully at what this means. Because the devotees of ISKCON, who are feel themselves loyal to Srila Prabhupada, try to follow his instructions carefully, who try to conduct the affairs of this institution under Srila Prabhupada's directives, they're sometimes accused of being mundane religionists. How is that? Well, what often goes on as the understanding of mundane religion among mundane people who are critical of religion, but they themselves are also mundane, is that mundane religion is narrow-minded. Mundane religion is too exclusive. Mundane religion is sectarian. So, when they see the devotees following a rigid path, not liking to compromise, wanting to uphold the principles, wanting to preserve what Srila Prabhupada has given us, speaking only from Shastra, from the Bhaktivedanta purports to the Shastra, then they say, you're too narrow. And that means you're actually mundane. You see? Now we have to learn to deal with this argument. So what we need to understand, first of all, is that we devotees, although we are aspiring to keep our consciousness within that Bhiganamai and Anandamai level of Krishna consciousness and self-realization, still, we too have to do our service in this world, and that means we also have to use the mind. We have to engage the body in activities. We have to eat. So these are the three lower koshas, so to speak. So we are also using them. So when one uses the mind and the intelligence, what does that mean? What are the functions of mind and intelligence? So intelligence, buddhi, this is the facility of viveka, discrimination, discriminating between what is right, what is wrong, what is true, what is false. It is the facility of determination, of following a particular path, strictly. The mind is the faculty of sankalpa vikalpa, accepting and rejecting. And that should go on under the direction of the intelligence, good intelligence. But in any case, to use this mind, and remember I said general definition of the mind includes also intelligence and false ego, or if one is aspiring for spiritual life, then one is trying to act under real ego, as spirit soul. So anyway, ego must be there, and intelligence, and mana, the mind itself, that constitutes the subtle body, which in general is called the mind. So if we use the mind, then we are going to discriminate. So this is very self-serving, and this is cheating, actually, for someone to point at a devotee and say, you are not impartial. You are partial. You are making distinctions. Therefore, you're mundane. This is totally hypocrisy. This is bizarre hypocrisy.
That in itself is
discrimination, is accepting, rejecting. Yeah. You can't get away from it. Everyone's doing it. This is my point. You see? So this type of argument to establish who is on mundane platform and who isn't is totally bogus. You see? And this we all need to be very, very clear about. Because devotees I've seen, when met with such type of accusation, devotees often they kind of feel off balance, and they've, and that's because we ourselves, we should all keep ourselves in the category of neophyte devotees. So as neophyte devotees, this sticking to this path is troublesome. It's our austerity. So when someone challenges us that you're too fanatical, you're too rigid, and if we ourselves are feeling a little unsettled, then the force of his argument may knock us off balance. This I've seen happen, and we become a little doubtful, because I myself following this, it's not always so easy. So he's saying, because I'm too strictly following, therefore I'm on the mundane platform. Maybe that's why I'm having trouble. You see? Especially when the one making the accusation can give some, persuasive logic. But we should understand what's really going on. There's no validity at all to that argument. It's just an accusation. Accusation means pointing the finger. When you point your finger at someone and say, "You're not partial," you're not impartial. You're partial. You're sectarian. Blah blah blah. Whatever. You see, when you point the finger, look, it means three fingers are pointing back at you. You see, you're involved in the same process because you're categorizing this person. You're being, you're separating yourself from this person. So this is what it means to work with the mind. So the way to determine whether one is on the mental platform is not there. It's not making arguments of someone is following some path too strictly. But what we have to see are what are the values. The values above, under which my buddhi and mana are doing their business of discrimination and accepting and rejecting. That's the question that we have to examine. What are the values? So values in Sanskrit, who knows?
Guna? No.
Value.
Artha.
Yes. And so, this is a big discussion, values in philosophy, and we're not going to waste time. We're going to, as they say, cut to the chase. So we can say there are two ultimate sorts of value, mundane and transcendental. The mundane value is called purushartha. The transcendental value is called paramartha or parama purushartha. So, easy understanding of the difference between the two is purushartha or mundane value is what I want. What I want. And this is Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur calls Gauna Dharma. Gauna means indirect. You see, because we're in this world, we're not in the spiritual world. We have body, we have mind, and these are given by Krishna to be used in his service here. So, as we are speaking of using the mind and making discrimination, we're obliged to do that. So all, dharma for the neophyte, we can say it all begins more or less on the Gauna Dharma platform. One is coming to Krishna consciousness. Krishna consciousness, we understand from Srila Prabhupada, but it's transcendental religion. But why are persons coming to Krishna consciousness? Like Krishna says in Gita, four classes, they're pious. Sukriti, they are pious. But they have materialistic considerations in their very reason for approaching the shelter of the Lord's lotus feet. Even the urge to knowledge, to transcendental knowledge, What is that? That's desire for moksha, liberation. And that falls within purushartha. That's what I want. I want to be free from this material world. Therefore, I want this knowledge. So there's what we can, you know, there's this nice word, interface. Yes. By the mercy of the Lord and the Acharyas, there's an interface between what I want and what the Lord wants. This is the way Krishna speaks Bhagavad Gita. Srila Prabhupada nicely explains this. Srila Prabhupada said, actually in one lecture, he said, it's very interesting, that up until the point where Krishna says, sarva dharmam parichaja, mamekam sharanam braja, which great acharyas like Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur and Baladev Vidyabhushan have said are the charan shloki of the whole Gita. That means the pinnacle of the Gita, just like a mountain comes to a point, a tip. So that the high point of the Gita, everything is building up to that point where Krishna says, you surrender to me. So Srila Prabhupada, in one lecture, he explained that before that, coming to that point, the Lord is urging Arjuna to do his duty with different kinds of arguments. For example, he warns Arjuna, even he says that you won't be able to attain the higher planets like the Kshatriyas do if you give up the fight. You will be ridiculed. The other Kshatriyas will call you a coward and a eunuch. So this is, you know, these are not really transcendental considerations. But there's an interface. But the whole line of the argumentation is to bring Arjuna to the point of full surrender, unconditional surrender. So Srila Prabhupada, in explaining this, he said that when Krishna says sarva dharma pratyuta, what he means to say, what he's actually saying is that up until this point, what I've told you before is all, I'm quoting Srila Prabhupada as best I can, what I've told you up to this point is all more or less nonsense. Prabhupada used that phrase, all more or less nonsense. Then Prabhupada said, not nonsense. But Krishna was giving, for those who are not actually his devotee, he is giving them some platform in which they can come closer and closer to devotional service within the Gita. But for his devotee, he's saying sarva dharma pratyuta. And so this is the whole scheme, to bring Arjuna up to that point. And then Prabhupada nicely explained that this, before these other things, before the point of surrender, Prabhupada said, bhoga dharma, tyaga dharma. Now this is very revealing, bhoga, tyaga. What are these? We were speaking of the mental plane. So that's what it's all about. Accepting, rejecting. Becoming attached to something to enjoy it, bhoga, and then renouncing it, tyaga. So this is the distinction between mundane and transcendental religion. Mundane religion is ruled by bhoga. Everything in it can be brought under these headings. Bhoga dharma, tyaga dharma, which is, both are pervaded by I want. I want. I want not. You see? Bhoga, I want. Tyaga, I want not. But I want. And transcendental religion is what Krishna wants. Therefore Krishna is saying, surrender unto me. Just surrender without any other consideration. And do what I say. So again, Mukhya Dharma. Mukhya Dharma means the real Dharma, the actual Dharma, and Gauna Dharma, indirectly. So even in the Gita, there are indirect recommendations, but the ultimate is there most prominently. The Mukhya Dharma. So when one is on the mental platform, this is called Manorata. There's that well-known verse, Manoratina Asati Davatobihi. So a person who is Krishna Abhakta can have no good qualities, actually, because he's only situated on the platform of the mind. That means whatever good qualities might seem to be there are all conditional. They're not absolute. Absolute means without regard to desha, kala, patra, time, place, circumstance. They are. They must be. You see? We must serve Krishna at all times, all places, all circumstances. Even if time, place, circumstance makes that service very difficult, we must find a way to serve Krishna somehow or other. If nothing else, subtly, but we must serve Krishna. That's what it means to be a devotee. You see, but one who's on the mental platform, then everything is adjustable. Everything is conditional. Everything is provisional. So, Manorata means... let me complete my thought. Therefore, Prahlad Maharaj is saying in this verse that one who's on the mental platform actually has no good qualities. Not really. Because he may appear to be, you know, very a gentleman, very well-behaved, very considerate. But if something happens that disturbs his mind, you see, if a situation changes radically and then his mind is, you know, groping, then all these seeming good qualities right out the window, you see? And suddenly he may become very selfish and inconsiderate, and just like, oh yes, example, it comes to mind, there was a movie made recently, but I'm not thinking of that. Reading Giriraj Maharaj's book, he's written in his book, Watering the Sea, there's one article he wrote called Titanic Disasters, I think. So he's writing about the good ship Titanic. A few years ago there was a movie also about this. But anyway, the Titanic was a ship, you know, the biggest ship in the world at the time. And the first class passengers were all very, very aristocratic, wealthy people. But after the ship struck the iceberg, then, you see, some of these people who were supposed to be so aristocratic, and they were acting so selfishly just to save their own lives. There was even a case where one man, it may have been the one who designed the ship actually, he was on the maiden voyage, where because they had announced only women and children, the lifeboats were not enough for everyone. So only women and children should get on the lifeboats. So he grabbed a shawl, a woman's shawl, and put it over his head. And people, you know, were just running around wildly. So he grabbed one child also. And he had the shawl around him, and then he had the child like this. And then he got on the boat, disguised as a woman in all the confusion. So this is, you know, very ignoble. Very unknowable. So, yeah, given the right, or maybe we should say the wrong material circumstances, then a person who is on the mental plane, seeming to have good qualities, is exposed as having no good qualities. So manorata means one is bringing values. Values are established in the Shastra. Values are represented by acharyas. Acharya means they teach by example. So he brings values underneath the urges of the mind. And this way he makes values simply the service, the servants of his attachments, his mental attachments. This, for example, is very evident in politics. Politicians are the par excellence representatives of manorata values. Values because that are all under the mind. Because the foremost consideration for a politician is to be in office. So he can say anything, high ideals, blah, 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 to attract votes. But the main thing is to get in the office. And then once he's in the office, staying in the office, he'll do any damn thing to make sure he stays in that office as long as he can. He'll break every promise he made. And, you see, mental platform, Srila Prabhupada says, the mind, particularly when it's influenced by the motive passion, where all kinds of arguments and theories and concoctions. So he's also very skillful, being very strong in the mental platform, the politician, to make all kinds of justifications, you know, reasoning. But that's what politicians do. They make all reasons to explain to the people why what they're doing is right. But other politicians, their competitors, see through these reasons and expose them. You see, he's talking as if he's your well-wisher, but he's not at all. He's only interested in himself. But then the same thing can be said about this person too. So this is the meaning. This is manorata. The self, the mind is swirling around, and it's the self, or the false ego self, which is at the center. And everything else, including religion, including law, dharma, whatever, philosophy, truth, everything, you know, all the ideals, they're just caught in this tidal pool, this whirlpool, cesspool, good point, of selfish mental speculation. So this is manorata. It is said about politicians that politicians, they change, you know, they change, say, their line that they're speaking, or they change their policies. Not when they see the light. You know what I mean? Not because they have some, you know, pure intellectual insight into what is right. You say, oh yes, now I finally understood. Yes, this is the right way to go. No, they never change their course by seeing the light. It's only by feeling the heat. That's a politician. When he realizes that the people who voted for him, you know, the people who can throw him out of office in the next election, are getting restless or getting, you know, agitated with him, and there are denunciations and calls for him to step down. Then he, oh, I have to do something. And then he makes all kinds of, you know, as they say, fancy footwork to try to adjust the situation. So this is the selfishness is at the core of it. So there's an interesting illustration of this, these mental gymnastics that go on upon this manorata platform. On the internet, one young man has posted on a website many sound files. You know, sound file you can download and hear on your computer. So many, many sound files from his ex-girlfriend. He had a girlfriend, and then he told her, after they had a relationship for a while, that this is not working, I don't want to see you anymore. So in the days that followed that, when he told her this, she was phoning him again and again and again, and leaving message on what's called the voicemail, the recorder on the telephone. And she sometimes was phoning like every 2 minutes for hours and hours and hours. And then what she's saying is interesting. In one message she's saying, "You nonsense, you so cruelly abused me, and I'm glad we're broken up. I don't like you, and you should lose weight anyway, you're too fat, and I've already got another boyfriend." And then 5 minutes later she calls and says, "You know, you're just a foolish little boy. You don't know what's good for you. So I know that you didn't mean it when you said we're broken up. So I'll come back and I'll be kind to you, and because you need me." And then 5 minutes after that she's calling and saying, "Oh, it's all my fault. I'm so sorry for all those things I said before. Oh, please take me back, please. I can't live without you." Then 2 minutes later she, "You idiot, you rascal, I hate you." Manorata. Mental gymnastics, you know, just saying anything, contradicting everything you just said 2 minutes before. And what is the ruling principle? It's attachment. The ruling principle is that, you know, I have to, you know, he can't tell me to go, you know. He's my boyfriend. I have to keep him. And I'll do anything. You know, I'll chastise him, or, you know, fall at his feet, or whatever. Mental gymnastics. So we were saying day before yesterday about guna pravahadi. This material mind is always agitated by the modes of nature. So mind begins, as you know, in the mode of goodness. Mind is in the process of creation, produced out of the sattva-guna. So mind begins there, but sattva-guna, material goodness, is impregnated with rajo-guna, tamo-guna. This is a useful analogy. There's a joke that a father heard that his teenage daughter, unmarried, is pregnant. So some rumor came to his ear. But of course she's still looking slim and all that. So then he asks her, "I've heard that you're pregnant." And she's very embarrassed, and she says, "Daddy, just a little bit." So if one is just a little bit pregnant, that means in a few months, one will be a lot pregnant. Now no one can see, but later on everyone will see the condition. So the same is with this material mode of goodness. It is impregnated with rajoguna, tamoguna. So again, mundane religiosity, they aspire for that mundane mode of goodness. Their so-called, you know, priests, saintly persons, try to represent the mundane conception of goodness as much as possible. But sooner or later, the lower modes will come up. And because of this condition of the mind cycling through the modes of nature, therefore such a mind cannot resist, as I was explaining day before yesterday, these vasanas, these urges, these powerful impulses, begum, which are coming from the stock of desires in the subconscious, and they're pouring into the mind. And so such a mind, always agitated by the modes of nature, not steady, becomes a servant of these urges. So what that means in short is, such a mind is uncontrolled. So Srila Prabhupada, writing in Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 1, Chapter 1, verse 10, purport, he explains that in the name of religion, again this is mundane religion, all kinds of sinful acts are going on. Because their minds are uncontrolled, therefore their senses are uncontrolled. Therefore they have to act upon the lowest urges. And Srila Prabhupada concludes this section of the purport by saying that the whole atmosphere in this, because he's talking about Kali Yuga religion. So he says the whole atmosphere is surcharged with faithfulness. So samsayatma vinashati, Lord Krishna says in the Gita, that those who are doubting souls, they fall down. They can never attain the transcendental position. So what is that doubt? What is that samsaya? You see, they're locked into the mental platform. They're on this manorata platform. They're thinking the mind is themselves. If they have any idea of soul, they think it's the mind. And this is the state of their mind. Their mind is uncontrolled. Their mind is host to all kinds of lusty desires, which are uncontrollable. So therefore, they have no faith that the mind can ever be controlled. They think this is just the way things are. Here we are. And so this is mundane religion. This is what mundane religion means. Existing on the mental platform. And so they have, you know, their interpretation of Shastra, which is all going in this direction. Like, for example, we even heard this a few years ago, even from one of the leaders of ISKCON who went away. And one hears this, I've heard this in India, from members of the Hindu religion. And Krishna in Gita, he says to Arjuna, what can repression accomplish? Now what he means there is that your adhikar, your capability, is as kshatriya. You're kshatriya, you're meant for fighting. So, if you take sannyas, because that is Arjuna's proposal, to become a bhikshu, a mendicant beggar. But Krishna is saying that is not your adhikar, that is not your capacity to do this. So you will fall down. What can repression accomplish? Now what the real context of this is that Arjuna has his dharmic duty as kshatriya. So he should do that, he should not repress it in the name of doing something else. But the Kali Yuga misinterpretation of this, the mental plane misinterpretation of this, is that we have so many desires, you see, coming into our minds. So, you know, so many urges. So many attractions are out there in the world. So what can repression accomplish? But the context of the Gita statement is all within Dharma. It's a question of one Dharma, Kshatriya Dharma, or the Sannyas Dharma. But what they've done is they've dragged in Adharma. You see, sinfulness, and said, Krishna says, what can repression accomplish? All these things are out there, and I'm young, and my senses are very agitated, and why shouldn't I enjoy? So when religion goes on in this platform, then you see that's the given. Religion on this mental platform, the given. You see, all these mundane religions, of course, they're all at each other's throats over so many, you know, doctrinal issues. But there's one thing that they all agree on, because they're all situated on this one platform, that God has given us this world to enjoy. You see? This is Dharma. You see? There's this world and it looks so nice. It's so full of so many attractive things. It's God's creation. He must want us to enjoy it. Otherwise, why did He make it look so nice? Why did He make these young girls so pretty and attractive if He didn't want us to enjoy them? If He really didn't want us to, He would have made all the young girls ugly. Etc., etc., etc. So this is the basic conception. That we're here to enjoy. So therefore, the mundane religionist, what he's seeking from religion is assurance that everything in the end will be okay, even though I can't control my senses. See? In the end, everything's going to be all right because I belong to this sect, because there's this nice priest here. If I commit sins, I go to him and confess or whatever the process is, and he does some ritual for me. He reassures me. He tells me, no, don't feel too badly about yourself. You're nice, you're a child of God. You see, we're not perfect. On and on. And to bring this a little closer to Krishna consciousness, you see, such a person, he'll want to be a devotee of God, a devotee of Krishna. But he'll want to be normal. You see? Normal means he wants to be nicely fitting in with the world around him. You see? Part of society. He wants to be accepted. He doesn't want to stick out like a sore thumb. He doesn't want to be considered a misfit, weird. So then, you know, religion is all internal anyway. So how you appear outside, what you're doing outside, that's less important. But being normal, you see, let's look at Bhagavad Gita. Prabhupada points out that Arjuna's proposal to be non-violent, to leave the battlefield, that is normal. That's normal. Arjuna's lamentation that if I fight, I'll kill my own family members. And then how will I enjoy? And that's normal. Gandhi, Mohandas Gandhi. This was his principle. Non-violence. He wanted the government of India to administer this nation nationally and internationally by the principle of non-violence, which is, of course, absurd. Even in mundane politics, what to speak of teachings of Gita. But he's celebrated as a great person. Because of Manoratha, he was saying things that appeal to the mental plane. People like that. Oh yes, sounds very good. So, but Krishna smashes this idea. And Prabhupada said, this is the whole intent of the Bhagavad Gita, he once said. How did he put it? That people in this world, they are living under the conception, Prabhupada used this phrase, of my own men. You see? This is by this, what Prabhupada called skin disease. You know, people are divided into races and nations and so on, family groups, by the relationship of skin to skin, blood to blood. So this is normal. This is mundane. And Krishna smashed this whole conception into smithereens in the Bhagavad Gita. Krishna could have told Arjuna, you know, Krishna's God. So he could have said to Arjuna, All right, Arjuna, you fight. I want you to fight because this battle has to be fought. But I'll arrange it that you won't have to kill anyone you like. Anyone that you like that's you won't have to oppose your guru, Drona, grandfather Bhishma. Oh, give me a list of names. Tell me the names of those persons that you would find heartbreaking to meet in battle, and I'll arrange it that, you know, and you just will fight the ones you don't like. You see? Krishna didn't say that. Krishna was totally uncompromising. There was no room for I like. This I like, I want. Krishna left no room for it. This is the meaning of total surrender. He could have exempted at least, you know, at least Dronacharya, Bhishma Dev, Kripacharya, these great souls on the other side. But he didn't. He wanted to so thoroughly, so completely smash this own man conception. This bodily, bodily relationship. So, a mundane religion is servant to such conceptions. And that is the, you see, when we speak of sectarianism, that is the real definition. Mundane sectarianism means that because he belongs to my group, then he must be good. No matter what he does, I'll stand by him. You see, no matter what he does. No discrimination. This is the problem with the Kaurava side. That all those terrible things were done. They tried to strip, drove all these years and years of horrible acts, all engineered by Duryodhana, with the approval of Dhritarashtra. And even the great souls on the Kaurava side, they went along with it, Srila Prabhupada said, because of their economic dependence upon that dynasty. And so, therefore, they all had to go, every one of them. So this is the mundane idea, you see, because we have our relationship, our close, near and dear relationship. Therefore, even if this person is the worst type of offender, we will stay by him. We will somehow try to work it out. We have to go on. Smash. Krishna smashed it. So this is, yes, this is normal, mundane affairs. The mundane devotee wants to be inspired in his normal, mundane affairs. Therefore, he doesn't want to hear words like surrender. Now, that's anathema. But what is Bhagavad Gita all about? Bhagavad Gita is all about surrender. We said, charan shloki. He doesn't want to hear heavy philosophy. In 13th chapter of Gita, Lord Krishna begins by saying, now I will speak to you from Brahma Samhitam. Brahma Samhitam means from the Vedanta. I will be referring to that knowledge which has been propounded by great sages of the Vedanta. I'm telling you about the field of consciousness and the knower of the field. Krishna speaking this Gita, he says in the fourth chapter that this Gita is meant for saintly kings, Rajarishis. That means that the topmost class of men who are intelligent, both intelligent and powerful. They are fit to be the rulers. And Arjuna is such a person. So we see very clearly, Krishna is telling Arjuna to surrender. Krishna is speaking philosophy. Does Krishna talk about prema to Arjuna? Does he talk about lila to Arjuna?
No.
No. But the mundane devotee, he doesn't want to hear about surrender, he doesn't want to hear heavy philosophy. He wants to hear about prema and lila. Because this will inspire him. You see? Some nectar for my ears, and then I can go out to my tea stall, my chai stall, and serve the tea. And this is going on. You know, when I come to India, I have been spending a lot of time in Vrindavan, and also sometimes I'm going to Delhi. So I get to know people. You get to know these people coming to Vrindavan. And there are many people who live in Delhi. And they have in Radhakund their guru. And their guru is Babaji with long beard, and he is speaking only Leela Katha. And they're coming a few times a year from Delhi, from their totally mundane life. Totally. When I stay in Delhi, I stay at the place of my godbrother Gorsundar Prabhu. So he has his office, used to be the Prabhupada Centennial Office, and he's kept it for life membership, and now he's involved with the BBT archives and other things. So I stay there, and this is in Sant Nagar, which is a neighborhood. So in this way we get to know people. And you can see their lives, totally mundane lives. But, you know, his guru is a Babaji in Radhakund. And yes, I'm going on Radhastami or, you know, some other holy day, and I sit at the feet of my guru and he's speaking Radha Krishna Lila. But what good is that doing him? To hear about, this is what Srila Prabhupada says, if one is on the mundane platform and one is hearing about the pastimes of Radha and Krishna, then how that will be understood? You see? And this is how they understand. They understand it in a mundane way. So Srila Prabhupada, in his purport to Canto 7, Chapter 8, Verse 10, citing the Anyabhilashata Shunya verse, he says that as soon as one has material desires, one cannot use his senses, his intelligence, his mind, or anything else for the satisfaction of Krishna. He's very clear in this purport. One who has material desires in the heart cannot serve Krishna, cannot satisfy Krishna. Therefore, he explains there that the real and original desire, the spiritual desire, must be brought forth and become the only desire. In this way, then one can render devotional service. Pure devotional service is motivated by only one desire, and that is to satisfy Krishna. And all these other desires have to be made shunya, null and void. Otherwise, one cannot satisfy Krishna. So, the mundane mind, this manorata, this guna pravaha mind, is simply maintaining material desires all the time. Maintaining attachment to so many material things. So that means that in that state of mind, it is really not possible to serve Krishna at all. according to this purport. This again is very uncompromising. So this causes even devotees, as I say, we should all consider ourselves neophytes. So as neophytes, hearing such statements, reading such statements from Srila Prabhupada may bring us to a pause. Well, what about me? My heart is not exactly pure. So how can I serve Krishna? So, a couple references in the 6th canto of Srimad Bhagavatam, 6.1.4, Srila Prabhupada explains, just as Bhakti Vikas Maharaj was explaining the same verse the other day, this Hamsavasya Prabhupada verse, Matak Sarvam Pavartate, Iti Matva Bhajanti Ma, Buddha Bhava Samanvita. That one must understand the philosophy. One must know the philosophy of how everything is coming from Krishna, how Krishna is the source of everything. One must have this knowledge, and then one can surrender to Krishna and serve Him Buddha Bhava Samanvita. This Bhava, Srila Prabhupada translates with, means, with great care and attention.
Worshipping with all their hearts.
With all their hearts. It also means, bhava means ecstasy. In that way they will experience the ecstasy of full Krishna consciousness. That means when the mind is totally given over to Krishna, at all times, all places, all circumstances. This is the meaning of seeing clearly how everything comes from Krishna. This is the consequence. That then wherever one is situated, anywhere, at any time, any place, one will be in full Krishna consciousness. So in that same purport, Srila Prabhupada says, the unintelligent can't immediately understand the supremacy of Krishna. Yes, there are persons who are not so intelligent as this. They can't understand. But he says, by associating with devotees and by reading authorized books, they can gradually come to this stage of transcendental knowledge of Krishna consciousness. Prabhupada says, although this may take them many births, this seems to be in reference to Bahunam, Janmanamande Gyanavamam Prapadyate, this verse. After many, many births, one finally comes to realize that Krishna is everything. So, then again, you know, we look at ourselves, so, I'm not so pure at heart, and I'm not so intelligent. I'm often, you know, I find myself struggling to be in Krishna consciousness in different time, places, and so what is my position? Shall I expect also it will take me many, many births? So in Mayapur, in a rooftop conversation, Srila Prabhupada said, there's a gentlemanly shortcut. A gentlemanly shortcut. The gentlemanly shortcut, he doesn't cite this verse, but what he says is just what Krishna is saying in this verse. Anyatveva majananta shutvanyeva upasate. Tepi chachintaratyeva mrityushuti parayana. So, one may be ajanata, one may be less intelligent. But if one becomes a regular hearer of this transcendental knowledge that is spoken, that is taught by realized souls, and in this rooftop conversation, Srila Prabhupada is saying, he said, brahmanas. He said, he was speaking very practically, saying these literatures that he is giving the world, they are meant for the intelligent class, not for everyone, Prabhupada said. They are meant for the intelligent class, the brahmanas, who will broadcast them, who will speak on the basis of these books with realization, and in this way impart this knowledge to others. So the others, who do not have this intelligence, they should hear from realized souls. And Prabhupada called this the gentlemanly shortcut. If one becomes a faithful hearer, one may not have so much deep realization himself, but if one faithful, what does it mean to faithfully hear? To follow also. You see? So if one simply hears and simply follows, Prabhupada called this the gentlemanly shortcut. Now, going all the way back to the beginning, I was talking about those persons who say, you devotees are sectarian. You devotees are narrow-minded. Their complaint is, you know, among these devotees, I often don't find so much deep realization. I often see blind following. I often see them acting without really knowing why they're doing what they're doing. So this all seems very shallow to me. But no, they're following the Bhagavad Gita as it is. This is the point. We have to, we all follow some path. This is what it means to use the mind. But I said in the beginning, philosophy is the attempt to use the mind to rise above the mind. And this is how one does it. If one hears this transcendental philosophy, this Bhagavad Gita philosophy, from realized soul, from Srila Prabhupada, and those who Srila Prabhupada has taught, who have become realized from Srila Prabhupada's teachings, and one fixes his mind in this process, even though initially we may not have so much realization, but this is the way by which, this is the path by which we ascend up from the mental platform. And those who simply criticize, oh, you're being narrow, you're being partial, you're making distinctions, you're being sectarian. What is their program for rising above the mental platform and thus becoming free from all these deeply rooted desires?
Just chant Hare Krishna.
Yes, this is the point. Prabhupada said there's a gentlemanly shortcut. There's also an ungentlemanly shortcut. And this is the
Hare Nama, Hare Nama. You don't have to do anything else.
These are the sahajyas. So the sahajyas, they like to think of themselves as advanced. You see, they don't want to simply be in that category of submissive hearer, surrendered, you see, following a prescribed path, performing prescribed duties, chanting a set number of rounds every day, doing the same things every day. No, they want to be advanced, which means to be independent and free. So therefore, this ideal of raga bhakti is very appealing to them. Raga bhakti means spontaneous devotion. They want to be advanced, they want to be free. So for them, they think, this is the ticket. This is the, this is the formula for me. Raga bhakti. So just by like self-declaration, they're suddenly raga bhaktas. And this is most offensive. You see, someone like Shukadeva Goswami, he could hear from his guru, his father, Vyasadeva, once, even while he was within the womb. And then as soon as he was born, he left the ashram of his guru and just went out into the world, acting upon, you know, acting under the under his realization, simply enacting his realization. That's Shukadeva Goswami. But if we presume that I can be Shukadev Goswami. Yes, I can enter, you know, in the beginning, the womb of ISKCON. Hear something, you know, hear some philosophy a few times. But then, boop, I get my realization. What am I doing here? Why am I, you know, following this narrow, rigid path? There's a whole world out there of spontaneity. And let me go and just act under the impulses of whatever. It's all Krishna. Everything's Krishna. And we've heard enough of this Bhagavad Gita. This is funny. They say like this, even the famous Gopi Baba Club in the 1970s. That Srila Prabhupada smashed when it was cooking up. I wasn't there, but you know, through the ISKCON grapevine, we used to hear about it. And I remember one quote came from my ears from someone in one of these meetings, said, "When I read Bhagavad Gita, I fall into Maya." They only wanted to hear about gopis and Bhagavad Gita put them in Maya. And I've already said, who did Krishna speak this Gita to? He spoke it to Arjuna. That means he's saying, I'm better than Arjuna. I'm more advanced than Arjuna. Lord Krishna's eternal associate. I'm more advanced than Arjuna. I'm more advanced than all those saintly kings that Gita has been spoken to throughout history. I'm more advanced than them. So this presumption is simply offensive. And one who is offensive, then, you know, they're precluded from any real spiritual life. But we don't have to consider anything further. One who presumes like that I can be like Shukadev Goswami, just hear once, and in this way be fully realized, and then go anywhere and do anything. Shukadev Goswami, yes. He walked around totally naked. But he was not of this world. And then, of course, as I've already explained, you see, on the mental platform, then all the justifications are there, so it can be pointed out to these persons that, well, we see practically you're not on that platform. You see, you have so many attachments and you're engaged in... You need this reformatory process yourself. Why are you claiming to be on the raga platform? But then they have all their elaborate arguments, justifications, blah, 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 blah. But we should know very clearly, even, you know, their defenses, their arguments are not important. What we should know very clearly is what is this mental plane and who is situated upon it and what is the process for getting off the mental plane onto the actual spiritual platform. Once we understand that, then who's who becomes very apparent. We need not waste time hearing all their elaborate blah, blah, blah justifications. So, tomorrow we'll get into blah, blah, blah. When we go into these different philosophies and theologies. Which are all, again, based on the platform of I want, not what Krishna wants. But today we are just establishing trying to show the essence of the difference between mundane religion and philosophy and transcendental religion and philosophy. So it's 11:20. Let's stop for questions.
Maharaj, sometimes in the name of real religion, we feel that something which is Manorata is involved. Just like there is controversy about this, nowadays gurukuls we have.
What?
Like gurukuls with mundane education. They say, what's wrong with it? Because, you know, they are accepted both the normal and spiritual, they get. So, what do you say?
And your question is?
The question is that, you know, even in ISKCON we are inviting something which is not actually something about.
Well, yes, in ISKCON we have to use our minds too, and so that involves vichar. Vichar means discussion of shastric points. Vichar can even mean, you know, argument, disagreement. But Srila Prabhupada said that the argument should not come to the process. We can argue about details, how to execute the process. But this argumentation should not come into the realm of the process itself. So, for example, in the question of education, well, we saw this in Mayapur. They had established such a school. The idea of that school, day school it was, it's called, it's still there, is so those who are running the school, their argument is that the children should be prepared for life outside, you know, to maintain themselves in the world. So it got to the point where they even stopped the recitation. They used to recite together Bhagavad Gita shlokas so the children could learn. But that even was stopped. And just this A-level, B-level, Indian type of education was there. Then Bhaktivedya Purna Maharaj and his followers, they opened the new school, which is Vedic-oriented. And a good number of the students from the day school transferred over. And this created a big outrage among those who were running the day school. And they went to the MAC, the Mayapur Administrative Committee, and complained. And the MAC told them, but wait a minute, you said your school was there to give a chance, to give a choice. So then why shouldn't there be the other school? The consequence of your position is that you want everyone, all children, to go only to your school and be trained in only this way. That means they actually have no chance. They won't learn Gita. So then, after they realized they couldn't stop the children from voluntarily, they voluntarily, by themselves, they wanted to go to the other school. Because Vedic culture is very attractive, very powerful. So when they realized that, then they reinstituted Bhagavad Gita recitation. they tried to make their school more attractive to devotees. Devotee children. So this is the thing, you know, the debate can be there, but it should not go as far as the process itself. And that's what happened in this case. And there may be other cases, and then that's unfortunate. Hopefully it can be rectified. This was a case that seemed to be somewhat rectified, because now it's peaceful. And even the day school now has some measure of Vedic education revived. So I think that was a positive denouement to that controversy. Anything else? Yes?
It is said that the living entities are Sanatan.
we cannot place anything where they were created. Then there was Eko Bahushyam. So this Eko Bahushyam, does it refer to the time when the human beings come out from the Lord Vishnu's body into this middle existence? Or?
Sa-ikshita. The Lord glanced over material, the material energy, all the jivas were within him, and they came out from his glance and entered into. And he also has gone with them. So in that way, he has become many, because he is within the heart of every living entity as Paramatma. So the jivas incarnate from the mundane platform. The Lord incarnates from the spiritual platform. Incarnate means to enter this world.
Then we said that the Lord expanded himself into many for increasing his pleasure.
Yes. Because their whole creation is intended, as Prabhupada says, to give a chance to living entities to go back home, back to Godhead. So if they go back home, back to Godhead, that means more devotees in the spiritual world. And that way, the Lord's pleasure increases. It increases anyway, but this is also contributing. Yes?
So, about these Pravita Vakas, and that kind of situation is present. So what should be the attitude of these more strict devotees or who are maybe leading, you know, preaching programs, because usually, you know, everybody wants progress in somehow or another. But should these devotees, like, for example, give lectures or what, you know, where goes the attitude?
Well, Prabhupada said not everyone can give lecture. There was in London, the devotees had permitted one club.
The guild. Radha Landanishwara Guild.
And they were having meetings. And in the course of their meetings...
That was mostly Indian people.
Yeah, Indian people.
Living outside.
But they would meet in the temple, and it was in some way connected with temple affairs too, but probably more predominated by their mundane affairs, social affairs. But the way I heard the story, then they were giving lectures in these meetings in the temple. And not to the devotees, but among themselves. And then when Prabhupada was visiting, there was some controversy had broken out. And so one woman came to Srila Prabhupada to complain about something that happened in the course of these meetings. The actual arrangement was that the temple management was taking a hands-off position, just giving, yes, you can come and do this, but we're not involving ourselves in what you're doing. But, you know, as it usually happens, when they got to loggerheads and couldn't solve their own controversies themselves, then this one lady went to Prabhupada when he was there and started, you know, explaining this happened, that happened, and Prabhupada didn't know anything about this guild or whatever it was called. And when he understood what was going on, then he told the temple leaders to immediately stop all this. A temple shouldn't be used for such kind of things, and persons from that level should not be giving lectures in the temple and being seen by others as some sort of authority, because you see from the way this lady saw it, somehow she was connecting this to Prabhupada. That was not the intention, but simply because it was going on in the within the walls of the temple, in the setting of the Iskan temple. This is the way the, yes, less intelligent will see things.
Prabhu Maharaj told me about this incident several times. He said that Prabhupada told him three times, only the most advanced devotees should speak in the temple.
That's according to the Maharaj. That's according to the Maharaj. For his mundane devotees to make distinction.
Oh. You mean if we say only the most advanced devotees, then that's sectarian. See, this is what I mean. This is so absurd. That's sectarian. That highly realized devotee should speak only.
That's not Manorata, that's Guru Sadhu Shastra Rata. There's a lot of difference.
But you see, this is the principle. On the mental plane, Atmavan Manyate Jagat. According to my contamination, I'm seeing everything else as having the same contamination. So my vision is polluted by sectarianism. So that means anything that I see, you know, where there's a division, a distinction made, I think it's coming out of the same motives as my own. Anyway, you know, the lesson that I was trying to make at the end here, when I was talking about the gentlemanly way and the ungentlemanly way. So those who are not very intelligent, there is certainly a place for them, and they can also become Krishna conscious in this lifetime. But if one is offensive, then the process is stopped. What is required? Well, what's required of all devotees, this is a requirement at every level of devotional service, is absolute submission. This is what Krishna asks of Arjuna in Bhagavad Gita. Surrender. We have to be surrendered to the system of knowledge that is originating with Lord Krishna Himself. When we commit offenses, then we are putting obstacles in our path. We can go no further. Instead, we will slide back. So this is the thing, you see. Then on this, you know, in this realm of the mind, the mundane realm, wherever there's ignorance, then there's always going to be the possibility of offenses. Therefore, achikitsya. There are those who are uncurable. Achikitsya aparadhi. This is the example of the snake and the milk. Milk is there, liquid dharma, but if a snake drinks it, it only increases his poison. And he also pollutes the milk by the touch of his mouth. So therefore we have to be sectarian towards them. Because they become more poisonous and they will pollute our association. So it's not doing us any good, it's not doing them any good either. We also don't want them to become, you know, to their offensive nature, to because a Vaishnavish devotee should be merciful. So therefore, this principle of neglect, in a purport in Chaitanya Charitamrita, Srila Prabhupada, citing Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati, states that when a Vaishnava neglects someone, that is also his mercy. So this is how our, so to speak, sectarianism is manifest. We may neglect someone, not welcome them into our association. But that is also a mercy. Because their nature is such that if they come into the association, things only get worse for them and also for the association itself. So it's better they be neglected.
You're saying that there's a tendency just to think that, well, we just join some sect, and then that in and of itself is the mundane religion sees that just by joining a sect, and that in and of itself puts him in the right position, and everyone in my sect is right, and everyone outside of that is wrong. That tendency can arise within our own society also, that we tend to think because we're in ISKCON and therefore we must be right, and anyone who's not in ISKCON is wrong or off.
Yeah, well, this is again with the, when the this principle of knowledge, the transmission and reception of transcendental knowledge, is foregone, when it is, you know, allowed to fade into the background, because that is why ISKCON exists. It's right there in the name, International Society for Krishna Consciousness. That's why there is such a society, to promote Krishna Consciousness. And the Bhagavad Gita is the book of Krishna Consciousness. So the process given in Bhagavad Gita is the means to Krishna Consciousness. So if that process is allowed to fade into the background, and simply the institution, again, this the morphology of the institution comes to the foreground, yes, then that same mundane sectarianism is increasing. That's true. Yes?
They preach sometimes to scientists in the mundane academic language and in scientific language. So how much it is on the mental plane?
Well, my whole talk was to try to point out, you know, it's always questions like this that make me wonder, did anyone understand what I said? So I kind of, you know, have to stop and think for a minute. My whole talk was trying to make clear what is the difference between mental plane and transcendental plane. So transcendental plane is also within this world, Anandamaya, Vijnanamaya, and it works through Manomaya, Pranamaya, and Anamaya. You see, we have this body, we have this mind, we have to use it in Krishna's service. So the thing is to use the mind, but not be on the mental plane. And that's what I was trying to distinguish in my talk for the last hour and a half. Trying to say what the mental plane means. So the material mind is the mind through which the three modes of nature are evolving. Material mind is, you know, focused on this false ego, the false conception of the self. I want is the prominent value. The material mind is ridden with mental speculation. The material mind is riddled with uncontrollable urges for sense gratification. That's just an encapsulation of the things I was talking about at length. I'm repeating them because I'm not sure if you heard all this or not. So just to use the mind, for example, to use the vocabulary of science to preach Krishna consciousness, that in itself is not the mental plane. because we have to use the mind in this present state. I said the other day, it's we're not like Rajneesh. You know, you won't find a sign before the ISKCON temple. Shoes and minds must be left here. But Srila Prabhupada, we heard him say that when we are polluted with material desires, then we are unable to use the senses, the mind, the intelligence, or anything to satisfy Krishna. They can be used to satisfy Krishna if they're used without the pollution of material desire. That's what we mean by the material platform. Material platform means essentially the mental platform. So if you're using scientific language, philosophical language to preach the pure message of Krishna consciousness, that's not the mental plane. If you're using this language to yourself become a scientist or a mundane philosopher, that would be the mental plane. Yes?
I have a question regarding the previous class.
Oh yes, you're allowed to ask.
You have presented this diagram of sin, of path. And on one of the corners there was the stock of sinful reactions in the form of the seeds, unlimited stock. And you said that actually Paramatma is the one who is managing the stock. Which of those reactions have to come to a particular living entity in order to teach him something? And this, as I understood, is relating to all the living entities. And my question is, what about statement among the devotees that Krishna is managing our karma or changing our karma? So if he is changing or managing the karma of all the living entities, what is the difference?
He's doing it differently for the devotees. Doing it for the devotees to bring them to the shelter of his lotus feet. So a devotee may have a reaction in store. Say, you know, he's scheduled to experience some pain. So for one thing is that Krishna minimizes. For his devotees, he minimizes such reactions. And another thing, the token reaction that he gives it in such a way that reminds this devotee of Krishna. Of course, if the devotee wants to be reminded of Krishna. Our will is always, you know, our free will also must be engaged in this. But Krishna arranges things in such a way that if the devotee is a devotee, actually, then he will be brought closer and closer to Krishna. He will be reminded of Krishna, think of Krishna, pray to Krishna. Whereas the non-devotee doesn't want to surrender to Krishna. So, therefore, he has to accept the full reaction that is due to him. The purpose of this is punishment. And that punishment is also, in the end, it is meant to knock the nonsense out of him, you know, so that he concludes, I must also surrender to Krishna. But the devotee takes Krishna takes special care of his devotee because the devotee intends to surrender to him. So the Lord, Srila Prabhupada, he says it's like a parent. Mother of one family will take care also of children of other families. You know, it's kind of a collective child care thing. So her children are there, but also neighbor children. So she's taking care of all, but naturally she has some special concern for her own children, always. So the devotees are like the own children of Krishna. Yes?
Kumar, yesterday there was talk about the kalpanas, and related to that, there has been like preaching years back that when devotees having some miseries because of their mind, they have to skip the mind. And according to that yesterday's explanation, it seems that that falls to the category of the Mayavads to deal with their minds. So it should be like, well, we have dealt with that in the seminar, but seems that that is not the proper preaching, just to skip the mind.
You can't skip the mind. Skipping the mind is already within the mind. But this whole philosophy is to, the whole point, or one of the important points that I'm trying to make here, is that this whole creation is based on the original nature of the Lord. So there's an original mind, a pure mind, a spiritual mind. So if now our mind is contaminated and giving us trouble, we have to purify that mind, not skip it. If your mind is impure and then you skip it, that's just a program for allowing your mind to remain impure. So this will not help anything. Yes?
The other day a question was asked regarding how to ascertain an authority. So there the answer I gave that ultimately morality is the basis for ascertaining.
Achar. Better to say achar.
But still I couldn't understand exactly, because there are many sects whose main philosophy is to work on the level of morality. So then their authority, the authority which they are following, seems to be okay.
Well, Vaishnava achar is ideal, and that is clear, because in Srimad Bhagavatam, Chaitanya Charitam, these scriptures, we have the most elaborate explanation of a definition, explanation of ideal qualities. Nothing else comes close to it. So the morality that is preached, say in other religions, is very meager, very primitive compared to this, and also under the modes of nature. So because under the modes of nature, it is inconsistent. Like Prabhupada pointed out, Christian scriptures say, thou shalt not kill, but they kill. They kill so many animals to eat. The original statement in Hebrew, lo tirtsach in Hebrew, simply says, thou shalt not kill. And there's a Hebrew-English dictionary, if you look up the word tirtsach, it means any type of killing. That's the definition given. But now you ask these people, no, it means thou shalt not murder. So again, this is manoratha. Their definitions are revolving around going to the TV. Hare Bol. Hare Krishna. So their definition of, you know, good behavior, etc., is all revolving around selfishness under the modes of nature.
Talking to them, arguing with them, how to then we understand, but how to argue on this point? Because morality is like.
Well, how do you understand? You understand from the Shastra and from the practice. So that's how they'll understand. If they don't want to accept Shastra, or they don't want to accept the practice, then they won't understand.
Yeah, just like Patanjali has shared six different philosophies, so why only we ask that? Why not Patanjali system? Why not others? We follow this authority, not Vyasadeva authority.
I don't understand. I don't understand what that has to do with morality.
It means our standard of morality will be different from their standard of morality. Morality is a little more of subjective thing.
No, there is objective morality. This is another thing. This is when you put everything on the mental plane, then everything is subjective. And there's, you know, they don't, because they're mundaners, therefore they cannot allow that there be anything absolute. You see? Because that will threaten their own attachments, their own system of attachments. So they will say, yes, you have your own system of whatever, but that's your attachment. I have my, and this world, God has given us this world, we can all live and enjoy this world. You see, we just have to make some harmonious arrangement between ourselves. This is the whole mundane. But there is objective, just like this room, we're sitting in a room. And this room has a definite measurement. Now, if you just ask me how big is this room, I can give you an opinion. Well, it seems to be so many meters long and so many meters wide. So, and someone else can be asked and he gives his opinion, it may be different from mine. That's approximation. But because different opinions are different about the size of this room, that doesn't mean that the size of this room is therefore, not defined, not exact. It does not mean that the size of the room to me is this big and to him is that big. That this room somehow has the power to, when I look at it, to become exactly as I think, and when he looks at it, it becomes a little smaller. That's absurd. It just means that I don't really know, he doesn't really know, he doesn't really know. We're giving our opinion. So when, you see, these persons on the mundane platform, they don't know. That's why they're on the mundane platform. They don't have clear understanding of things. They have some idea of morality, religion, spirituality. Some idea, they give their opinion, and their different opinions, and because they're attached to the mundane plane, they think that that's the best they can do. You know, that's the best that can be done. Just give your idea. And there's nothing, there's no absolute beyond it. But that's foolish. That simply means ignorance. There is a way to measure this room and come up with a very exact figure. But because they don't know the way of the proper, calibration given by the Lord Himself of all things in this world, according to what is good and what is bad, what is right, what is wrong, what is true, what is false. They don't know this, therefore they speculate. And then when they argue that speculation is all there is, then they're cheating. Cheating. Yes.
Maharaj, as we know that Shankaracharya propounded the philosophy of Mayavadism, and after him very powerful acharyas or Vaishnavacharyas came. But even though till to date Mayavadism is the most prominent philosophy we have.
Mm-hmm.
So what was the weakest explanation that these acharyas came again to establish the Vedic religion, and that was Krishna's plan, but somehow.
Yeah, because this is the material world. There's a difference between the material world and the spiritual world. People come to this material world because they want to be in Maya. And Mayavad philosophy is the philosophy of Maya. So therefore, Mayavadi philosophy is certainly always going to be prominent. It's in a sense the original philosophy of materialism. We come to this world, why? Because we want to be God. And this is what Mayavadi philosophy says you are. Openly, you are God. You see? So this is why it's so popular, because that inner materialist that inner would-be God, he finally hears the nectar he's always wanted to hear. Finally someone is saying, I'm God. That's great. So the Vaishnava philosophy is for the sane living entities. And in this world there's not so many. Particularly not in this age, Kali Yuga. What?
Previous ages, we find that whole world was based on Vedic system. And
yeah, but still not necessarily on pure devotional service. You see, ultimately we have to be detached from this world. This world is never going to become ideal. That's why this world is. If our faith in Krishna consciousness is depending on seeing everyone become a devotee, then we're going to be disappointed. Yes, and actually that's another formula for being normal. First I'll try to be a devotee so that everyone will be a devotee, and that way I'll be normal. But after some time one realizes they're not going to become devotee. And I'm the one who's not normal now. So maybe I should become more normal. This is another kind of attachment. We have to be detached. If they don't take to Krishna consciousness, what can we do? We serve our guru by preaching as best we can, and the result is not ours. We pray to Krishna, please help this conditioned soul understand, but if he doesn't understand, what can we do? We just do our best. But it's finally up to the Lord. And if someone doesn't understand, I mean, why is that? Because they don't want to understand. And that's why there is this world. For those who want to be in Mayavad, it literally means philosophy of illusion. That's the exact translation. Vad means philosophy or ism. Maya means illusion.
My question is connected regarding this thinking willingly. So sometimes I find myself this question is arising because when I try to very eagerly desire something on the mental platform, it's not accomplished. I mean, nothing's going on. But somehow, by will, just in a second, I can do something. So it seems to me that I just have no way how to figure out what's going on. Because the willing is completely out of my control. And on the other side, when I, for example, I just want to lift my hand, and I just thinking, have desire to do this, but not willing to do this, nothing's happening. I can wish whatever I like, you know. But nothing is going on. And when I just will to do this, it's going automatically. So what is the difference exactly? I mean, this borderline which separates these two.
He's got his hand up. Maybe I should just ask him his question without answering this. I don't know. Thinking, feeling, and willing are states of the mind. So, yeah, willing means acting. Your question is not so clear. You may be trying to ask, is every action preceded by thinking and feeling before will? I'm not sure if that's what you're trying to ask.
For example, I just concentrate that I should move my hand, but somehow I don't move my hand.
Yeah, because thinking is not the stage of psychology by which we do things. Thinking is cognitive. Feeling is affective, emotions. And willing is, as they say, conative. It's the part of the mind that is involved in activities. And in the Bhagavatam we find the vrittis also. So five vrittis of the mind are the active senses. Five vrittis are the jnanendriyas. The mind is just looking through the eyes. This is not active. One vritti is the mind preoccupied by itself, with itself. Internal, you know, introspection and that sort of thing. So these are different engagements of the mind. So, I mean, I'm not clear why you are trying to jump from, say, thinking into an activity. I don't see why you are trying to make this link, because that is a different department of the mind. Nobody said that when you think, then an action takes place. Just like when you're looking through your eyes, that's another activity of the mind. But by looking at these windows back there, I'm not able to open it. And if I think I should be able to open it by just looking at it, then, you know, I don't know. I have a little bit of difficulty with the reasoning, you know. If I want to open that window, I know that I have to get up and walk over there and, you know, move it with my hand. And that's the willing function. I don't know what else to say. Yes.
I would like to ask you regarding suicide and that state of mind, because just recently we had some Mataji also, she jumped off from the ninth floor and from the building, and she just interested if you can explain us, was the, is it it's also a silly question, but I heard many explanations, and is it, I mean, mind is the worst enemy when it's uncontrolled, but, and then somebody said also there are some, you know, things about subtle beings and something like this.
Subtle beings. Well, when we become too absorbed in the mind, which is subtle, then we are entering the association of subtle beings, because they live in that plane. In Krishna consciousness, we should use the mind, but we should not become absorbed in it. Also, suicide, thoughts of suicide, actions, of course, of suicide. This is all within the mode of ignorance. One is committing suicide because one is hopeless, one is utterly depressed, or one is very angry at oneself. Actually, depression is just, what it really is just a form of anger at oneself. And this is all tamo guna. So, these subtle entities, they live in the tamo guna. So you can see that if one is, yes, very much absorbed in the mind, moreover, one is in the tamo guna, then this is like opening the door to the subtle entities. But that's as far as I'm going to say. If you want to know how much can we understand subtle entities will be involved in such, you know, I'm not going to try to answer that question.
No.
But it just, you know, a person who is very much in the mental plane and in the mode of ignorance will certainly be in a position where they can, I would say, they will be influenced by such entities, to what degree, how much what they're doing is under the influence of them. I'm not going to try to say.
Sometimes people, in case of, if they commit suicide, not because of hopelessness or some religious motive, or of course, like, you know.
Whatever, it's in the mode of ignorance.
So,
yes?
Maharaj is like someone who knows Shastra very well. And still he is in the conclusion that no, everything is sinful Maya Radha.
Uh-huh.
Out of his false ego, he doesn't want to accept what it is exactly. And he just feels that all road leads to Rome and all that stuff. How will he be placed in the next birth? There's any chance for him to become a devotee, or?
Well, there's a chance for everyone to become devotee. The question is, chance is there, but the question is, do we take the chance? See, and that's free will, and that's, you know, free will is the, like they say in math, you know, the X factor. It's unpredictable. I mean, it's really up to that person. So, chance is there. The Krishna consciousness movement is there. And for those who are, I mean, there has to be some bhakti sukriti. Sukriti means piety, and bhakti sukriti means specifically piety in devotional service. Someone may have a lot of jnana sukriti. So like you say, due to past activities, he has good knowledge of Shastra. But this jnana sukriti then is, you know, bending the interest in the way, in the direction of impersonal liberation. So a person with a lot of jnana sukriti and not much bhakti sukriti, it may be very difficult for them to take to Krishna consciousness. It's not impossible, but it may be difficult.
But if he does some jnana sukriti, without going, he does some devotional service, then maybe chant.
Yeah, of course, that always helps. That always helps. There's in Chaitanya Bhagavat, there's a narrative of Devananda Pandit, who knew the whole Bhagavatam, all 18,000 verses, and he used to give classes on Bhagavatam. But his line of presentation was not according to Shuddha Bhakti. So, once Srinivas Thakur was going by and he heard the Bhagavatam being recited in Devananda Pandit's place. He had a place where persons could come and hear him. So hearing the Bhagavatam, Srivas Thakur was attracted and he went inside and he sat down. And because he's pure devotee, then the vibration of the Bhagavatam caused emotional, transcendental emotions to come out. And tears were running down his face. Everyone else there was like dry philosopher. All those hearing, because that was the mood of Devananda Pandit. So, another person who was sitting near Srivas Thakur saw him going through these spiritual emotions and he thought, this is a disturbance, why he's doing this? He thought, he doesn't belong here. So he kind of picked him up, you know, you should go out. And he brought him out of the assembly. So Srivas Thakur, he didn't mind this, but Mahaprabhu, he minded. This actually happened before Chaitanya Mahaprabhu appeared. But after Mahaprabhu appeared and was starting the Sankirtan movement in Navadvip, he brought Kirtan around Navadvipa, and when he came to the place of Devananda Pandit, he stopped the kirtan. He stopped all the chanting in front of the house. And then Chaitanya Mahaprabhu was denouncing Devananda Pandit. He was speaking very loudly, saying, this Devananda Pandit, he thinks that he knows the Bhagavatam. People think that he's a teacher of Srimad Bhagavatam, but he doesn't know anything about Bhagavatam, and he never will know anything about Bhagavatam because he's a Vaishnava aparadhi. And then he took the kirtan elsewhere. So he didn't even allow Devananda Pandit to hear Harinam Sankirtan. So Devananda Pandit, because he was, you know, kind of like puffed up scholar, he thought this is not important. Then later on, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu took sannyas. Now why did Chaitanya Mahaprabhu take sannyas? Because he was concerned about the scholars, the students, the Mayavadis, people like that, so-called intellectuals, puffed up people. He was concerned that they find it very difficult to accept my teachings if I am in this grihastha ashram, because they think I'm just another, you know, just another Brahmana pandit like so many are there. But if I take sannyas, then they will respect, everyone respects at that time, 500 years ago in India. Sannyasi was very respected. So after Mahaprabhu took sannyas and left for Puri, then there was some change in the mind of Devananda Pandit. He was reflecting that this Nimai Pandit, he's actually a very great personality. And so because his attitude changed, then he was seeing if there was opportunity to render some service to the Vaishnavas. And so one saintly Vaishnava associate of Lord Nityananda came to that place. I think it might have been Ramdas Abhiram. I don't quite remember right now. But anyway, he was great preacher and kirtan leader of Lord Chaitanya's movement, Lord Nityananda's party. And so Devananda Pandit went there, and because this Vaishnava was in such ecstasy, and the people were also kind of mad with spiritual ecstasy, so there was a tumult among the crowd. And there was some danger that the crowd might press into this devotee. So Devananda Pandit, because he's respected as a Brahmana, he's a very respected person. So he took his staff, his walking stick, and he was using it to keep back the crowd so there would be some order in the assembly. So then later on, when Mahaprabhu visited Navadvip Dham again from Puri, then everyone was coming to see him, to take his blessings. And also Devananda came, but Devananda was shy because he was thinking, he was remembering what Chaitanya Mahaprabhu said about him. But he wanted to see Mahaprabhu. In his heart he was feeling respect. And then Mahaprabhu, he was shy, so he was in the back. He didn't like to come forward. But then Mahaprabhu called him, Devananda, come here. Because Mahaprabhu is sannyasi now, so of course he's Krishna. But they were seeing him as sannyasi, so he came forward. And Devananda Pandit, Lord Chaitanya said to Devananda Pandit that because of your change of heart, I know about your change of heart, and I know about this service that you rendered, nice service. So I'm inclined to give you my full mercy, but you have to become free of this offense you made of Srivas Thakur. So if you can bow down before him and take the dust of his lotus feet, then I will be satisfied. So he immediately did that. Of course, Srivas Thakur was saying, no, you shouldn't do this. You are a great person. So because he did that, he was humble, taking the dust of the lotus feet of the Vaishnava, then Mahaprabhu accepted him as one of his, and he became one of the important followers of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. So he was big Mayavadi. So the Mayavad philosophy, as I explained the other day, it's born out of false ego. Mayavadi is very proud because he thinks he's God. So that is the obstacle that must be overcome in order to become Vaishnava. Yes, Agyata Sukriti, these things will help. Just like he was doing Sukriti. But finally Mahaprabhu wanted him to become meek and humble, show his humility. And that was the test that he passed, and then he was accepted as devotee. So this is why it's hard for Mayavadis to be humble, to bow down. Someone who's thinking, I'm God, you see. But they can do it. They can. Whether they will, that's another question. Yes?
Perhaps there are three states of consciousness. There's this wakeful state, states of dreaming, and deep sleep. And everyone accepts that we are receiving the results of our past karma in the wakeful state. But what about this dreaming state? Do we also accept some karma? Or is it the state where mind is absorbed in itself?
Well, Prabhupada says devotees, they can, by the Lord's grace, they can be relieved of karma, good and bad, through dream. It's a special facility given by the Lord to his devotees. Yes?
When things are going this mundane direction, then political dealing seems to come up. Some years back there was, and it just has to meet a few challenges, some groups separated, whatever. So I was even advised to study the Niti Shastra, some of the Pandits things, and in order to, like, that pure devotee who told that to me, he said, like, Krishna is even using politics, so we can also use that. So I didn't find that very valuable, but is there a place for this kind of Nitisastras or this kind of in our preaching field when we face these mundane problems?
This will get you a kind of yes-no answer. We shouldn't become politicians. Vaishnava Shavata Atta, Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur, says that Vaishnava is simple. Sharalata means simple, not in the sense of foolish, but it means he's straightforward. It means he speaks the truth simply. He's not doing one thing and saying another. And this crookedness, this complexity, like you said, politics, that's very much part of politics. So if a devotee becomes a politician, then he can't be a devotee. This is, someone asked about Chanaka Pandit to Srila Prabhupada. Was he a pure devotee of the Lord? And Prabhupada said, no, he was simply a politician. So if one is in the category of politician, then one is not a devotee. At the same time, yes, it's true that Srila Prabhupada said Krishna engaged in politics 5,000 years ago. We were saying how Bhagavad Gita has spoken to the kings, saintly kings, and their duty involves politics. So this is another one of those things, like when we're speaking of the mind is something we must use in order to serve Krishna. But we don't want to be situated on the mental platform. We use the mind, but we don't want to be in the mind, absorbed in the mind, identifying with the mind. So, I think with this question about niti, and becoming knowledgeable, someone who has been endowed with an intelligence that can pursue this type of study, who has an interest and who can use it nicely, then I might, if they would ask me, I might say, okay, you study Niti Shastra. But a devotee whose main business is being a devotee, who's more along, you know, the traditional simple path of Krishna consciousness, I wouldn't recommend that they study this. In fact, I think if we just become very acquainted with Srila Prabhupada, his life, his behavior, things he taught, I think that that's the perfect education. Prabhupada also quoted many things from Chanakya, so, and he gave Krishna conscious explanation. So all of that is within our simple study of Krishna consciousness. I think that's sufficient. One doesn't have to go outside that. Okay, we have only very few minutes left. Anything else? Yes?
Maharaj, I was thinking, when we were preaching, then, well, we should know something about other philosophies. But should we know also applications and figures to win? How much should we know?
Well, again, that, you know, that depends on, it's similar to the answer. If someone has, you know, already built-in propensities,